Okay, so just to recap where we left off, it's been at least last week there were no lectures at all. So we were talking about deadlocks. Okay, just quick recap. We said there are four conditions necessary for deadlock: mutual exclusion, hold and wait, no preemption, and circular wait. Okay, the one that is key for deadlocks is this issue of circular wait, where some threads are holding resources while waiting on others, and the way you hold resources and the way you're requesting resources results in a circular wait situation, which ends up in a deadlock because no one is able to make progress. Okay, so we said there are three different ways of handling deadlock. There's deadlock detection and recovery. This is the problem of detecting deadlocks after they happen and recovering from them somehow. You can run a cycle detector on a resource allocation graph, check if there's a deadlock, see if there are many threads blocked, and then you could terminate some or all of them. That's one way. There are other ways to do that. Okay? And then there are these two other techniques, deadlock prevention and deadlock avoidance. Okay, so in deadlock avoidance, what we are trying to do is impose some restrictions on the system or how you write your program. So one of these conditions is always false, either in the system or in your program. So by definition, a deadlock cannot occur. Okay, so we already looked at a way to do that. I said if you write code, you can number resources, and when you are acquiring locks on resources, you acquire them in increasing order. Okay, this is often done in databases to avoid deadlocks inside database systems and so on. Okay, so that's deadlock avoidance, and what we have been talking about is deadlock prevention. So this is a runtime mechanism. There are no restrictions a priori on the system. So requests for resources, or in this case locks or semaphores, come in. You do some extra checks and runtime, and you ask the question, should I let this request proceed? And you only do that if the system stays in something called a safe state. And if you infer that granting this request put the system in an unsafe state, you are going to deny or make the request wait. So we started talking about this problem specifically in the context of deadlock prevention with resource reservation. Okay, so here, just gave an example, and I'm going to use that as a way to do a quick recap, and then we'll continue from that point on. So what we are trying to do is, in this case, each program or each thread has to declare what resources it is going to request over its execution. Okay, so in this case, the only resource for this program are tape drives. Okay, so and there are a dozen of those, and each thread declares how many, what is the maximum number of tape drives you could ever request over your execution, concurrent tape drive. Okay, so thread 4, it may need a max of 4, 8, and 12. Okay, and this table here captures the snapshot of the system. It says at this point in time, how many are in use, and how many more could you request if you actually had the worst case request coming in, which is your maximum allocation that you said you could ask for. Okay, so if you have said you could ask for 4 and you have 3 in use, then you could say I could want 1. Okay, one more. So the question is, if given this state, if a request for a tape drive comes in from any of these threads, one or more, should you grant it or not? Okay, and we say that the safe current state is safe if there exists any sequence in which you could execute this thread one after another sequentially, so that each of them could ask for their maximum and still finish. Okay, so in this case, we'll say it's safe because if T1 asks for its maximum, you could grant it the one tape drive that is, so there are 11 in use, there are 12 in the system. So if it asks for this one more, you could grant it that one. Okay. And then it can finish, because once it gets it one, it cannot ask for more. It continues execution and finishes. It releases the 4 it held, and then those 4 could be given to T2. Okay, so T2 can go to its max, finish, and then it releases all of its resources, which could be given to T3, and then T3 can finish. Okay, so there is at least one way to execute these threads. In this case, it just happens to be order T1, T2, T3. If you execute them in that order, they can still get their max and finish. Okay, so we say that that's a safe state. Okay, so that is what is mentioned here. Okay, now we say, let's suppose that T1 does indeed ask for its one tape drive, and you did give it to that. So now what has happened is this is 4 and that becomes 4, so it could not no longer want any, but there are no tape drives left in the system. Okay, now if you have any thread making a request, you will say this is an unsafe state because there is no way T2 and T3 can ask for more and make any progress at the moment. Okay. So you don't want that to happen. Okay, so that's so we are going to formalize this example through algorithms that will formally capture this idea. So you basically want to reason about what are the resources in the system, which of these resources are allocated, and if some thread makes another request, should you grant that request or not? And the idea is you will say that you will only grant requests that take the system from one safe state to another. You make a transition from a safe state to an unsafe state, you don't want to allow that request to proceed. You want to make it wait, because being in an unsafe state essentially means you can have a deadlock. You can have a cycle somewhere, and then if the thread is deadlocked, then you are not going to have any progress in the system. You would rather make that request wait, have some thread finish, and then grant that request at a later time. Okay. So one way, another way to do whatever I was just showing on the previous slide is to essentially look at the resource allocation graph and see if granting a request results in a cycle. This is a visual way of thinking about what I just showed on the previous slide. So this is your resource allocation graph. Okay, if you remember what I said a few lectures ago, the circles here represent threads. There are 4 of them, T1 through T4. The boxes represent resources. Edge going from a thread to a resource means basically says that thread has requested that resource. Edge in the reverse direction is an allocation thread. That means that the resource has been allocated to a thread. Okay, so there are what are called request edges and allocation edges. This way basically says you're requesting that resource. That way says that this resource has been given to that thread at the moment. Okay, so basically so given this graph, now if one of these threads, these dotted arrows here basically say that these threads can request these resources in the future. They have not made that request, but given that they said they could request these resources at the beginning of execution, you have these dotted edges here saying sometime in the future I could make that request. Okay, so now what happens is if a thread indeed makes a request, let's say T4 makes a request on R2. Okay, so R2 is currently free, there is no, it's not been allocated to any thread. So you could in potentially grant resource R2 to thread T4, okay? In which case there is going to be a solid black edge going from R2 to T4. Okay, that's an allocation edge. Okay? Now if that request is granted, then you have to ask what happens in the graph. Is there a cycle or not? There is no cycle right now. Okay, so this is a safe state because you don't see a cycle. These are directed edges. So although you see that there is a loop, you need that arrow to be flipped for the cycle to be complete. Okay? But if T4 actually requested R2, this edge would flip because R2 would be allocated to T4. Okay? That edge would go in that other direction and there would be a cycle. Okay, is that clear what I said? Yes.
Once the request is granted,
you basically have an arrow going from R2 to T4. Right now the arrow is in the other direction. So you will have an arrow going this way. That results in a cycle. Okay, if there is a cycle, you say that you don't want to have cycles in this graph because that can lead to a future deadlock. So you don't grant that request. So potentially what we are saying is if T4 actually makes a request for R2, even though R2 is free at the moment, think of R2 as a lock. Okay. If this lock was free, okay, typically a definition of a lock is you do lock acquire. If the lock is available, you grant that lock. That's what we say. In this case, even though R2 is a lock and it may be free, you will not grant it to T4 because doing so might will actually yield a potential cycle in the graph which can result in a deadlock. So you will tell T4 to wait. As if the lock, and you will pretend that the lock is not available at the moment. You will wait for one of these edges to go away. And then you will grant that lock. Okay, do you understand the implications of what we are saying? Even resources that may be free are not granted to threads that request them because doing so might result in a cycle, and that's an unsafe state. Yes, you have a question.
That makes sense, but so if you don't grant the Threads request for the resource, it's going to wait until it can get it, right?
That's right.
So if you had a situation where T4 requests the resource and is told to wait, then it ends up waiting. It's still holding the resources it's holding. How is that better than...
Okay, so the question is...
You still have the resource. I guess you could give it to T3. Is that the whole idea here?
Right. So what you will do is if you don't grant that resource, you will basically have an edge that's saying T4 has requested R2. Okay, so that's an edge going this way, that's not at a cycle. So you may then wait for one of these other edge to disappear. So here, R1 is allocated to T3. Maybe that's a lock that T3 is holding. At some point, it will release this lock, so this edge will disappear completely. Okay? At this point, it is safe to give this lock, because if this edge goes away, there is no cycle, even if you grant that resource. So you wait for some other resources to get released so that the potential for a cycle just goes away. Okay, does that make sense? So you may wait, there is a free resource. Okay, you can grant it, but granting that resource puts you in an unsafe state. So you will wait until some other resources in the system get released. T3 may not need any more resources before it releases this lock.
Okay, but if it does, it will be granted R2 because that wouldn't make a cycle?
If it is granted R2, you have an arrow going that way and you have got another request arrow going that way, so that's okay. So long as there is no cycle, you are fine.
Yeah. So R2 in this example could be granted to T3, but it could not be granted to T4.
That's correct.
Okay. That makes sense.
Because it's a directed graph and you will have a cycle in that directed graph. Is that clear? Yes.
And so what does it mean for a resource to be requesting a thread? Is that just...
What does it mean for a resource to be requesting a thread?
A directed arrow from R3 to T2. What does that mean, like, internally?
This basically means that, think of this as a lock. You have done a lock acquire and you are waiting for the lock. So you have requested the lock and you are waiting.
And now the opposite, R3 on T4?
That basically says you did a lock acquire and you hold the lock.
Okay.
Yeah, that's if these are locks, that is what it would mean. That you are holding something or you are requesting something and waiting for it. Any other questions here? Okay, very simple idea. You just check the graphs if there are cycles, and if there are cycles, you may defer allocation of resources even if they're available, just to avoid cycles in the graph. Okay, so that's basically what you're going to do here. Now the issue with this is only going to work, this cycle detection only works if you have one instance of each resource. You want to generalize this concept and make it work for arbitrary instances of resource, and that gets us into this algorithm called the Banker's algorithm. Okay, so you will see how you look for the same concept, okay, but now you are going to use a different method for doing this. Okay, so this algorithm, proposed initially by Dijkstra, handles multiple instances of the same resources, and like before, we are going to assume that threads will have to provide advance information about what resources they request. Okay. This is something extra. You typically, when you write any multi-threaded application, you don't a priori declare saying over the course of my execution, these are the 7 locks or semaphores I request. That's not done. But to execute any of these algorithms, any deadlock, not detection, but deadlock prevention algorithm, you have to declare a priori what is it that you will request over the course of your execution. Okay, so you have to provide this information a priori. Okay, and then we are going to ensure that you will always allocate a request to a thread only if you make a transition from one safe state to another. Otherwise, the thread must wait, even if that resource were available, just as we saw in the previous example. Okay, so I'll just show you some pseudo code first, and then we are going to do a couple of examples. Okay, so this is a Banker's algorithm written in Java using monitors. Okay, so n, you have n threads, m resources. Okay, each thread has already declared what resources it will request. Okay, so you have several matrices here. There's an available matrix that says how many resources are available in the system at this given time for each type. Okay. There's a max matrix. This is what each thread has told the system it might request. This is the worst case request you can make. Okay. There's an allocate matrix, that is a per thread matrix that says these are the resources each thread is using. Okay. And then there is a matrix called need that we are going to actually compute. So this is what is available, this is what you can request, this is what is in use. Okay. So what's there in the system, what's in use, and rather what is allocated and what is available. Okay. So I don't know if people in the back can see this, but I'll just give you the basic idea. Okay, so let's suppose a allocate request comes in from any thread saying allocate this resource to me. Okay, this is a generalization of lock acquire. To do lock acquire, you basically say allocate this lock to me. And you will first do the check and then you will call lock acquire, for instance. Okay. So first you check whether your request is greater than what you said you would need. Okay, if you are asking for more than what you declared at the beginning, that's clearly an error. You said I can ask for lock A, B and C, and now you are requesting lock D, that's not allowed because you didn't declare it upfront. Okay. So you will just throw an error and then you will wait. So long as there aren't sufficient resources in the system, if the request is greater than what is available, you clearly have to wait. Okay. The resources are not even there, so you are basically calling your condition variable and you wait. Okay. So here is what you basically then do. You say if I would grant this request, I'm going to subtract. This is a vector arithmetic here. So you take the available matrix and then you subtract the contents of the request matrix. So you basically say there are 10 locks, now one more lock is gone, so there are 9 remaining, for instance. Okay, so you do that vector thing. You're going to say this is what has been allocated to thread I. This is what thread I is going to now can ask in the future. Okay, you take that request from its need matrix. Okay, and then you are going to, this is the crux of it, okay, this is just some bookkeeping you do initially, this is the crux, you say, is this going to put the system in a safe state or not? Okay, so you call this safe state function, say, while you are not in a safe state, wait. Okay, if you are in an unsafe state, you got to wait. I'm not going to let you proceed, you have to sleep. Okay, and keep doing this check, this is again a monitor. Okay, so this is a condition variable, so until this condition becomes true, you are going to wait. So you are going to say if the current state is safe, only then do I actually move forward. Okay, so what might happen is if it is unsafe at the moment, you will wait until some other thread finishes execution and releases its resources, then you do this check again. Right? And eventually if sufficient resources are released, you might be in a safe state, in which case you are allowed to proceed. Okay? Yes.
Why do you check to see that the state is safe after you allocate?
So this is not actually allocated. This is just saying if you had allocated, then is that system state safe or not? That's all it is checking. Because you have not let it move, go out and do anything with it. So this is just checking what has happened. Okay. So, and this is what the safe state function does. Basically, what this is the crux of it. So you're actually doing a search. Okay, you're saying, is there a sequence of executions that I can find that will allow all threads or processes to make their maximum request and still finish? Okay. If I were to grant this request and then some other threads came along later and made additional requests, will they be able to finish, or will granting this request cause a deadlock? Okay. If there's even one execution sequence that lets them finish, you are okay, because that's not an unsafe state. There's no execution sequence that lets any other threads to proceed if this request were granted. Then that's an unsafe state because you are deadlocked. So I cannot find any way for, if I were to grant this request and then subsequently another request comes in, and there is no way for me to satisfy that request no matter what happens in the system, then you are deadlocked potentially. So you don't want to get there to begin with. Okay. So I'll give an example of how you can do this. Okay. So this is actually a search. Okay, this code is not actually real code, it's pseudo code, although it looks like Java code. So I'll show you how you can mechanically work through an example of how to do this safety check. Okay, even if the safety check succeeds, you are good. If it doesn't succeed, you are not good, meaning you are in an unsafe state. You will actually go and wait here in the previous slide. Okay. So you are asking that question, why have you allocated that request? So if you see here, it says if this safe state is unsafe, then you are going to undo this match, you are going to reverse this and restore those matrices back, and then you go to sleep. That's why I didn't put that code there, but you do have to add that. So let's look at an example to make this more concrete. Okay. It's a little abstract, but I can try to explain what we are doing. So here we have four processes, P0, P1, P2, P3. Three types of resources. There could be log, there could be hardware resources. At this abstract level, it doesn't matter. There are just three of them, A, B, and C. Okay? And you could have multiple types of each. You could have two instances of resource A, one instance of resource B, and so on. Okay? When each of these processes start, they have to declare over their execution sequence, course of the execution rather, what are the resources they could request, whether they are locks, tape, drives, printers, disks, doesn't matter what those resources are, we just declare. So P1 has said it could potentially ask for one resource of type A, 7 of type B, 5 of type C, okay, over the course of its execution. That's its worst case needs. Okay, you cannot ask, so that is what it declares when it starts up. And it tells the system, these are my max needs. This is what P2 has said it would request, 2, 3, 5, and P3 said 0, 6, 5, and so on. Okay. This column says what are the, at this point in time, what resources are each of these processes holding. Okay. So this says P0 is holding one resource of type C, none of type A and B. Here you are saying P1 is holding one of type 1 and so on. Okay. And this last column says what are the idle resources, what resources are unallocated in the system. So this is, we still have one of type A, 5 of type B, and 2 of type C free in the system. Some one of these threads could come and ask for some of those resources. Okay, yes.
The available column is when all of the resources are allocated in this way, this is what tells
you? Yes. So the total resources clearly will be this plus this. Right? So this is what is in use, that's free. Okay. So that's the current state of the system. Okay. So this is saying at some point in the execution, at some snap, take a snapshot, this is what the system looks like. There are four processes. Each process has declared what it can ask for. This is the resource, this is what they're holding. These are the resources that are free. Describes what is happening in the system. Yes, question in the back.
Okay. This algorithm seems like it'd be very close system, but is this something that's usually learned in a more modern OS? Or?
Okay, so question is, this algorithm, do you have to learn it in a more modern system, more modern operating system, or is this how it works? So as I had said last time, and I'll say that again today, most operating systems actually don't do any deadlock detection at all. Because if you ask your program, every time you write your code, if you have to tell the system, this is what I'm going to request, you keep track of it and so on, it becomes too complicated. Okay? So OSs don't do this. Okay? But if you're writing a complex program of your own, you might have to embed this in your program just to reason about whether some thread should go ahead or not. Okay? Or you wrote a library that says, I'm going to have a locking library of some sort. What should the library do if it were to implement deadlock detection? So that's where it would go. So typically these types of things would go either in a library or in your own code. Like you can, if you're writing a database server, for instance, you might want to do this inside the database server, even though the OS doesn't do it. Yes,
this
question.
This is sort of tangential, but does the OS itself know its available resources, or does the software have to detect that on the specific machine that it's running?
Typically, when the OS boots up, it will detect what hardware exists on those machines. Because either it is told to the OS through a configuration file, or there are mechanisms that go and probe and figure out what resources exist.
Right, but do I mean, does the OS track these resources as they're being assigned, or does the software itself have to track them?
So typically, the OS wouldn't do even that. It wouldn't do any tracking, it wouldn't care at all. It leaves all of this task to the application programmer. Anything in user space, you want to prevent deadlocks, you write your code and figure it out. The OS is not going to do this. Okay, that is just because you're trying to prevent the complexity at the OS level. You have just put that in the library or some other piece of software like a middleware. Okay. Okay. So you will see all of this actually implemented either in what is called middleware. These are software layers that sit on top of the OS to which you program to, or in libraries, okay, that you may have implemented. Typically, OSs wouldn't track, OSs wouldn't figure this out. They may know what resources exist because you have to have device drivers to manage resources and so on. But they don't do any of it. They don't track it and figure out when to grant, when not to grant. That is handled at a higher level. Okay? Okay, so that is the snapshot. And here are a few things just for us to understand what's going on. So the first question is, how many types of resources are there in the system? We already answered that. We said this is what is in use, this is what is available. So you add this up, that's the total number of resources in the system. So there are 3 of type A, there are 14 of type B and 11 of type C. Okay, you just take those two things and you add them up. Okay. Then the next question is, what is the contents of the need matrix? Need matrix is defined as the number of resources you are still allowed to request, okay, based on what you said. Okay. It should be clear that if this is what you said you could request in the worst case, and this is what is allocated to you, you take this and you subtract this from this, you basically get a value that says this is what you're allowed to request. So just as an example, is P0 allowed to request anything? Okay. It said it would ask for 001, it is holding 001. So it cannot possibly need any more resources, but it already has its max. Okay. So its need vector will show 000. Okay. Here you have 065, and you've been allocated 063. Okay. So P3 could potentially ask for 2 more resources of type C, because it said I could request 5, I only hold 3. So its need vector is going to be 002. Okay. So basically, if you take max and you subtract the allocation part out of there, you get the need matrix. Okay. So I'll show you what the need matrix. And last question is that system in a safe state, and we'll answer. That's the crux of the question here. Okay, so that's the need matrix. Okay, it says need is max minus allocation. Okay, I said resources is total plus available. Now we have to ask the question, is the system in a safe state? Okay, and what does this mean? It basically says that if all of these processes come back and ask for these resources, okay, this is the worst thing that could happen in the system. Okay, all processes decide, I said I could ask for 075, give me those resources. And then P2 said I could ask for 100 more resources, give me those. And P3 would say the same thing. Okay. If you get this request, is there a way for you to finish execution of these processes in some order and yet satisfy all of those requests? Okay. So if you find a sequence, in this case, you have to manually work through it and find that sequence. If you find that sequence, you are good. If you don't find that sequence, or you try all sequences and you don't find one, you are in an unsafe state. Okay, here we claim that you are going to be in a safe state, and we'll see why. Let's go back here. Okay, so you have to try to find some execution sequence. And let's say in our sequence, we say P0 already holds it max. Let's it continue and finish execution. Okay, so it's going to finish, and it's basically going to do 001. Okay. P1 can go next, and if it asks for 100, there's still one of this resource available. So P1 can go to its max. There's already enough resources in the system at this point, because P1 can ask for one more resource of type A. There's one more resource of type A free, so you can let P1 execute next. It will go to its max, it will finish, and it will release all of these resources, 175. P3 can ask for its max, because that's allocated, that's not the need matrix. P3 needs two more of C. Okay, so it said it would ask for 5, it's holding 3, so it can ask for 2 more, and those 2 are available in the system. Okay, so you can let P3 finish, and then those resources would get released. You add them back to the free pool, and then you'll see that you can finish, I mean, you can execute either P1 or P2. Okay?
I think you have to execute P2 first.
If you have P0 and P3 finish, you will release 064. So you will have 1116. If you have 1116, that is, both these matrices are smaller than 1116. So you can have either of them go next. Okay, is that clear what I said, or should I repeat that? Okay, maybe you should. Okay, so what we say is this current state is safe. Okay, because we know that if you leave the system in this state, every process can actually ask for resources, and you can do P0, P2, P1, P3 or P0, P2, P3, one of these sequences, and you can still bid up. Okay, so there could be multiple sequences, you just need to find one. Okay, so now you say, okay, so current system is safe, another request from P1 comes in and it's now asking for 052, and should you grant it and or should you not grant it? Okay, so what you will do is you will basically run that algorithm I just was showing you, the Java code. You will pretend like you granted that request. You will recompute the system state. So you will say, if you grant that request, what is the new system state? Is that system state safe or not? Okay. So you pretend like you granted that resource, you find the new allocation need available matrix, and you see, is it safe? It's safe if all of the processes can still make their max request and finish in some order. If you can find such a sequence, you are good. If not, it doesn't work. Okay, so I'm just going to put the solution, and we can look at the solution here. Yeah, so it basically says, if you ask for 052, first of all, there are enough resources in the system, because there is 152 and you just ask for 052. So you can certainly think of granting it. And then this is the new state of the system. Okay, after you granted 052, all that is left is 100, and P2 here now is holding 135, and that's the max. So these two columns have already switched here. So the previous slide, they were the other way. Okay. And then you can say, is there a way I can take that 100 matrix and finish these in some order? Okay, P0 can always execute, it's done. It can release those resources, then you will have 101. Okay, what can you do with 101? You have to compute the need matrix, and you will see that P2 can still continue because it can only ask for one more of this resource. So you can grant it the one that's available. So P2 can also finish. So P0, P2, P3 are done, they release their resources, you can then go and execute P1. Okay. Just simple arithmetic, you have to find a sequence. Okay. So you can do this sequence and you will be done. Okay. Typically you don't do this using hand. The code that I was showing you here, this is where that search happens. You look at sequences by saying, is there a, so this is our safe state code, they say, is there a sequence I can find that will do whatever we are doing mechanically by it? If you find that, you will grant that list. If not, you will say, no, I cannot grant it. Okay. There's questions on this banker's algorithm. So it is important to first understand the high level concept, what we are trying to achieve. Each thread is being asked to specify what resources it might request. You are tracking what resources are in use, what resources are available, and at each point, whenever a request comes in, you are reasoning about the system. Is this a safe state if I granted this request? Can the remaining threads finish, or will we have a deadlock in the system? If you think that there is going to be a deadlock, you shouldn't grant that request to begin with. That's what we call an unsafe state. Yeah. And then the simple way to figure out whether there's deadlock is assume that you have the worst case where every thread makes a request, and if there's no way to finish, they're all sitting and holding some resources and waiting for the others, and then you're stuck. That's a circular wait. Okay. Any questions here? So we'll do a review of this again during the discussion section, but the broad idea is to keep it in mind, you are just checking in when you do deadlock prevention, whether it's through a resource reservation, through cycle detector, or through banker's algorithm, they're all trying to do the same thing. They're going to do extra checks and deny allocation requests if you go into an unsafe state. Okay, typically in a normal system, this is not done. Okay, everything we have learned so far, if a lock is free, grant that lock. You are not going to say, if I grant you this lock because it's free, it will put the system into an unsafe state. That is what all of these techniques will do, okay, if you actually implement. Okay. So just a quick summary before we move on to the next topic. So we talked about three types of techniques: deadlock prevention and recovery, detection and recovery. You don't put any restriction on the system. Periodically you run some checks saying, is there something wrong? Are all the threads just waiting? Is there a cycle in the graph? So you wait for deadlocks to occur and then you try to recover from it. Okay? So this is the least restrictive. Meaning you don't put any restrictions at all. You say, I will address the problem after it has occurred. If there's no problem, I'm not going to worry about it. Okay? So in the optimistic case, if by and far things are working fine, there's nothing to do. Okay? Once in a while things might go wrong, then you have to recover from it. You might have to terminate or kill applications and so on. Okay? Least restrictive, but more work to do later. Okay? And then we talked about deadlock avoidance and deadlock prevention. In deadlock avoidance, we are trying to impose certain restrictions, so one of the four conditions for deadlocks don't occur. Okay? And we said the only real condition you can relax is if you have a cycle in the graph. So you want to write your code or whatever system you are building in a way that doesn't introduce a cycle to begin with. If you are no guaranteed that there are no cycles because you have written that code, by definition there is nothing to do. There won't be a deadlock. Okay? Little more work when you write the application. Okay? But once you write the application, nothing needs to be done. Okay? And deadlock prevention is the middle ground. It says the programmer can write whatever they want. Okay? When requests for resources come in, I'm going to do checks at runtime. So it's a runtime mechanism. I'm going to do the check at runtime. Reason about, is this safe, is this unsafe? If it's unsafe, I'm going to make that thread wait. Okay, so least restrictive from a coding standpoint, and also but a little more work at runtime. Every time there is a request, you have to do more work. Okay? Here you do that work only after the problem occurs, only after the deadlock has occurred. Here you don't do work any work at runtime. This is all design time work. You try to make sure that there are some restrictions so that on your system, so one of the four conditions are always false. Okay? So nothing needs to be done. Okay? So different types of techniques. Okay? So the thing that you should keep in mind, and we asked that question was asked earlier, is what do operating systems do? They don't worry about it at all. They don't even do the recovery. They say it's not the operating system's problem. Okay, let the user reboot or do whatever else they want. Okay, or let the system do this at the library or in the middleware. Okay, that's not to say that this topic is of no use. If you are actually writing code, you need to worry about it. If you are building systems like databases, you need to worry about it. So there are practical uses of this, but as things go, OSS haven't adopted any of these techniques. Okay, they have left it to higher level pieces of software in the stack. Okay, so any questions here before we switch gears? So we are actually done with the discussion on CPU scheduling, thread synchronization, deadlock. That was the first major component of the course. Okay, now we are going to switch gears and do the next major piece. Okay, so we did. So thus far we have covered processes and threads, CPU scheduling, synchronization and deadlock. Okay, this is the next big topic. And then what is remaining are IO file systems and distributed system. Okay, so four components of the class. First big one is done. Okay, so we'll start memory management. Okay, so today is going to be more of a gentle introduction, and then we will start looking at more sophisticated memory management technique. Okay, so what do we want to do as far as memory management goes? Okay, so you have, every machine has RAM. We want to know what should the OS do to manage RAM on that machine. Okay? How is that RAM allocated to processes? Where do you put the process in memory? How do you allocate more memory when the process grows or deallocate when the process shrinks? Basically, how are you going to do all of this at the OS level? Okay? So to understand that, we are going to start with some very simple memory management technique and then build it up from it. Okay? So we'll first answer where does the executing process go, how do we allow multiple processes to coexist in memory, and then we'll also ask that question, what's the memory address and how is it generated, how is it used, because that's the crux of how memory management works. Okay. So going back to this picture I put up in the second lecture, okay, so this is the CPU and the caches and so on. That's the system bus. This is the memory. That's the disk controller. So we are going to talk about this piece. The basic point is whenever you start any process up, it gets loaded to memory. Instructions are fetched to the CPU. CPU executes them, does operations on data and memory, and basically when the process is done, you deallocate. Okay, so question is, how are you going to manage the memory piece now? So let's start with a very simple idea. We'll first do some terminology, and we'll start with a very simple idea for memory management. Okay, so three terms that will be introduced. Segment is a chunk of memory assigned to a process. Okay, so if that is main memory, 2400 words. Okay, so this segment is allocated to process B. This segment is allocated to process C. That segment is allocated to process A. The OS kernel itself is also resident in RAM. Okay, the OS is also running, and it has a piece of memory allocated to itself. Okay. Typically, your memory layout is going to look like this. Okay. That there are some pieces, so this gray piece regions are now pieces of memory not in use. So certain pieces of memory are in use, certain are not in use, and then processes can grow and shrink, and you have to allocate memory accordingly. So segment is a chunk of memory assigned to a process. A physical address is a real address in memory. Okay, so here memory addresses go from 0 to 2399. Okay, it's not 2400, it should be 2399. For 2400 words. So that's a physical address. If you say what is stored at location 10, you will take the 10th word in memory. So your linear addressing will take the 10th word and look at that memory content, and that's what is stored at location 10. That's called a physical address. It's the real address of a memory region. Okay? As we will see in a moment, most processes don't actually deal with physical addresses. They actually deal with what are called virtual or logical addresses. Okay, I'm going to use the term virtual address and logical address synonymously. They mean the same thing. Okay? So virtual address is an address relative to the start of a process. Okay? So what does that mean? So here is process B. Okay? It is 400 words long, and it is going to do its addressing, saying go look up this region in the stack or whatever, with respect to itself, not with respect to physical RAM. So it assumes that its address is go from 0 to 399 because it's 400 words long. So it will generate, say, what is at location 10. Okay, when I said what is at location, physical address 10, we actually meant offset 10 from the in physical RAM. But if process B says what is at offset 10, and this is a virtual address, you have to actually look at the 10th word that is related to the start of that process. Okay? Not the 10th word in physical RAM, but the 10th word that is related to the start. Okay? So virtual address is address that is related to start of a process. Okay? The reason it is easier for processes to deal with virtual rather than physical addresses is because when you write the code, and when the compiler compiles the code, the compiler has no idea where the OS is going to put this process. It could put it in any region in memory. So you can't deal with physical addresses typically, except in one case that we'll see next. Okay, so typically you deal with virtual addresses, and something else has to happen to take that virtual address and map it to a physical address. Okay, this is called memory translation, something that we'll also look at in a moment. Okay, let's start with the simplest. There's one more thing. Where do addresses come from? And then we'll start with the memory management. Okay, so addresses are generated at various levels in your design cycle. Okay, your compiler may generate addresses. Okay, because if you're writing C code or something like that, and you have pointers, the compiler has to write some code to generate that address. Okay, you may generate addresses at load time. Whenever the process is actually being loaded from disk into memory, we'll see that you might have to generate some addresses, or you may actually generate addresses at runtime. Okay, so it could be compile time, load time, or runtime, and it'll become clear shortly what kind of addresses are being generated at each of these phases. Okay, so we'll start with uniprogramming. Okay, simplest memory management scheme. We'll assume only one process can run at any time. This is the old days of operating systems where you could only run one process at once. You could not even start more than one process at once. Okay, so if you're uniprogramming, it's very easy to do memory management. There isn't actually much to do at all. Okay. We'll just assume that the OS is loaded in high memory region. It's loaded at the last portion of memory, and all processes are always loaded starting address 0. Okay. So at this point in time, process A runs, nothing else is running, okay, and it's loaded starting zero. And then once process B finishes, this is uniprogramming, so only one process. Process B will run and then C will run. Okay, and then there's some region of RAM that is not in use, depending on the size of that process. Okay, so this is uniprogramming. If you have uniprogramming, then as you can imagine, because all processes actually start at physical address 0, the physical address and virtual addresses are one and the same. Because any address that is relative to the start of the process is also relative to the start of RAM, because you are starting with relative address 0. Okay? So in this case, you don't have to do much in terms of memory management at all, as we will see. Yeah, because you just generate physical virtual addresses and you just load the process, and so you, by definition, the compiler knows in uniprogramming the process will start at physical address 0, so there is nothing to do really. Okay, now let's take a case where this is not true, no longer true. You want to load more than one process at once and you want to somehow make it all work. Okay, so what are the goals you want to strive for? So when you are multiprogramming, which is the norm, we want to ensure these three goals. Okay? First one is called transparency. Okay? What does transparency mean? We want multiple processes to coexist, but they don't know of one another, neither should they. Okay? You can run 25 processes or 300 processes, and each process runs as if it is not aware of the presence of other processes. Okay? Or it should not be made aware. Okay? So we were basically making this sharing transparent. Memory is shared, but this is transparently shared to processes should not care where they are loaded. Okay. Second one, which is also very important, is called safety. Okay. Because multiple processes are executing in RAM, you don't want one process to trample on memory allocated to another process. Okay. Each process should only deal with the memory region allocated to itself. It should not be able to access or read the memory that's allocated to another process. It should not be able to override that memory region. Okay? This is a critical point in safety. This is why sometimes you have viruses in your system, because there are backdoor ways to override the safety problem. Okay? You come and you override some memory region, and then you are basically taken over the machine if that happens to the kernel memory. So typically, for reasons of safety, you don't want to be able to corrupt the OS, neither should you be able to corrupt the process, nor should not only corrupt, but even read something else that's up. So you don't want a virus to come and read what is happening in the browser if you are logged into your banking site, for instance, and get your password, because these are two separate address spaces. That's the safety issue. Then the last one is efficiency, where we say the performance of the system as a whole should not degrade because you have multiple processes and you are trying to somehow manage a piece of RAM and sharing that RAM across lots of processes. And you don't want efficiency to suffer because of the sharing. Okay, so you want transparency, safety and efficiency. So for each of the schemes that we will look at, we'll also ask the question, how transparent is it, how safe is it, and how efficient is it? Okay, so let's start with the first one, which is called relocation. Okay, so now we no longer have the luxury to believe that there's only one process. You can load up as many processes as you want, subject to the size of RAM. Okay, if you have RAM, you can free RAM, you load up more processes or start more processes, and that's allowed. Okay, so simplest form of multiprogramming is what is called relocation. What happens here is still OS is loaded in high memory region, but processes can be loaded anywhere in RAM. Okay? Processes can no longer assume that they will be loaded starting physical address 0. Can put them anywhere. Okay? The only restriction we have is the entire process needs to be contiguous in RAM. Okay? This whole process A is taking a contiguous chunk of memory. Okay, so it's not going to be split across multiple regions as yet. We'll see how to do that as we go along. Okay, so now you can ask the question. So okay, fine. I mean, you want process C to come in. You just find a region of memory that's large enough to hold it, and you load it there. That's all well and good. But then you have to ask the question. Now, how is this process going to do addressing? how does it generate addresses so it can access the stack or the heap or some particular instruction, and how does that work? How does the addresses get translated from virtual to physical address? Okay, is the question clear what I just said? So we let multiple processes be resident. Each process is supposed to be contiguous, okay, and you can load the process wherever it wants. But then the question is, having put a process somewhere, how are we going to generate physical addresses? Yes.
Are you asking rhetorically, or are you asking the class?
No, I'm asking the class.
Okay, sorry. So then you just take your start location, your end memory address, and your start memory address, and you can request within that range or only allow within that range, depending on your perspective.
Okay. So suggestion is you take your start address and the end address, and you can only request memory region within that range. Yes, that is indeed true, because if you do something outside that range, you are allowed to access, the system is allowing you to access a memory, part of memory that's not allocated to you. But the point is, when the compiler generated code for process C, it did not know it would actually be loaded at location 900. Right? Yes.
Well, if it's a certain pointer at spot 10, it would be at 910.
Yes, that's a good observation. So basically, what you are saying is, if you are, let's say that's 900, and you basically say if you want offset 10, then basically that translates to 910, because that's 10 words relative to the start of the process. But I am asking, who is actually doing this work of figuring this out? Right? How do we get this? Because when you load it, somehow offset 10 should become 910. Okay? Because that's the right physical address. Yes.
So the operating system knows the base when it assigns the region of memory for the process, and the process can figure out every other address in its memory region by just adding the base to that. So I would assume the base is stored in a register or something, and every time the process wants to access a location of memory, you take the location it wants to access and you add the base.
Okay, so you have a base register. Suggestion is you have a base register where you store the start of that process, and then every time you generate an address, which you are going to generate virtual addresses, so you will actually generate 10. Okay, you have to make that, translate that to 910. What you are going to do is take that virtual address and just simply add this to the register, and then you get the physical address. Okay, this is called runtime translation. You are generating addresses at runtime. Okay, because every time you generate an address, you are actually going to take the base and you are going to take that address. There is some logic that is going to take this, do this addition, which we can easily do in our minds, but the OS has to do this automatically. So it will use these register values and do it. Yes.
So I actually have a question on that. Does the operating system do that? So is it the operating system is intercepting the process's access to memory and adding the register, or is it adding the base, or is it that the process was compiled to know that it needs to add the value in a specific register?
Okay. So, good question. Right? So, question is the OS going to do that? Is the compiler generating code to do that? Or is something else doing it for you? Right? So, that is the reason we are talking about this at all. So, you'll see that there are multiple answers depending on how you actually realize this concept in practice. Okay, so just hold on for 1 second and we'll get back to that.
Is it done in hardware? I remember in turn from the architecture class, translation look-aside buffer.
Okay, translation look-aside buffer, TLB. We haven't gotten there yet. Okay, TLBs are a cache. It is a piece of hardware. It's not doing any translation for you. It is a cache that is actually going to store these results in there. So next time, you don't have to do this arithmetic over and over again. Okay, but there is some hardware. Okay? But I'm going to first propose an even simpler solution. Let's say you don't want to use hardware at all. Or let's say you have a very low-end CPU and a machine that has no hardware support to do this, no extra registers available. What could you do in that case? Yes. You could partition it into segments and hand them out, but then when you do that, how do you ensure that the addressing works okay? Because if you handed out this segment, you have to now translate, do this arithmetic and say this address 10 is actually 910. Or if you had put it at 500, then you would have to do a different translation, address 10 becomes 510.
Well, you can still do higher or lower, and then just say, okay, the kernel is the high word, and then the lower word is what?
If the kernel says that, you are actually doing this at runtime. You need some support to do it. I'm saying if you didn't have that support, is there an alternative approach? Yes, on this.
Make the request for a specific location and then deny or allow?
Yes, so you could, you are, that is an extra check. We haven't even gotten to safety yet. We are just saying, let's first do the translation, then we'll do the extra check, right? So I'm going to go back to the slide which I said, where do addresses come from, okay? So you can generate physical addresses at compile time. That only works for uniprogramming. And then we have these two options. Do it at load time, do it at execution time. All of what has been suggested is actually falls into this category. We are going to either have some extra hardware, or OS is going to do this extra work, do this arithmetic and generate addresses. But you could do this as well. Okay, so what does that mean, doing it at load time? It simply means the compiler has actually generated machine code, okay, where it has, let's say, you will say load, okay, you will say, you have an address like that, load offset 10. Okay. Or you could say add R1. So you have these kinds of instructions that is in the machine code. Okay? Now when you are loading this program, you can simply take the offset value and look for each such instruction and modify that value. Okay? Instead of 10, you can make this 910. Instead of 20, you make that 520. Okay? So you are actually scanning all of the instruction as you are loading the process. Every address you see on any assembly instruction, you add the base value to that address. Okay? This is what we are doing at runtime, because you took 10 and you added 9, but if you are going to load that process and you know where you are loading that process, you will actually scan the code and you will modify every address in there, replace the virtual address with the physical address, and that's simply done by just adding the base to the offset. Okay? If you do this, then when the program runs, the physical address is already in the assembly instruction. There's no more translation to be done. Okay? You're just going to say load to 910, and that's the physical address that you really need to access. Okay, is that clear? What I said, yes.
So wait, what you're saying is that when the program is loaded into memory initially,
yes,
all of the references are going to be converted?
Exactly. So you have, you have assembly machine code, which is really assembly code, right? So you have something that says load 10, you have add register R1 0x20. So this is what is on your disk. This is the executable that your compiler has generated. When you load this program, when you start this up, this code has to be put in memory. Okay, as the code gets loaded, your OS is actually scanning, actually is the loader. Okay, there's a thing called a loader that's responsible to load this program. It's actually scanning the instructions, and every time it encounters an address, it is going to say, where am I loading this process? Okay, at location 900. So what should I add here? I should add 900 to this offset and make this 910. Okay? So you'll actually modify all the addresses that were generated and replace them with physical addresses. And then you load the process, and then you're done. No more hardware necessary in this case. Okay? So, if you do this, okay, you only do the work at load time and you don't need any extra hardware support to do the memory address translation. You may need hardware support to do checks on safety. That's a different problem. Okay? Now, but also the downside is if you do this, then you are stuck because you cannot move that process from that location. If you try to, if the process grows, let's say you have BAC. If A needs to grow in size because you just started allocating memory, you did a lot of mallocs or you did ran a lot of constructors and your heap has actually grown in size, the size of that process will grow. But clearly there is no way to grow A because C is sitting right next to it. The only way to grow A is you have to actually move C, make some space for A and grow A. If you have to actually move processes because they are growing and shrinking and you do the translation at load time like this, then either you have to retranslate every time, or if you do it once, then you cannot move it at all. Okay? So load time translation is a one-time job. There is no extra runtime overhead of doing that addition. Okay? But you basically have some limitation. You can't move the processor along and so on and so forth. Yes.
What is the load time cost like for that? Because, I mean, there's obviously no runtime cost, but it seems like that would be somewhat expensive to have the loader try and understand all of the instructions and figure out which ones are addresses and which ones aren't.
Right. So the runtime cost is the cost of scanning machine code, identifying instructions in the machine code, and if the instruction actually has an address operand, you have to take that address operand and add a offset, add the base and change that operand. And it is going to slow down the loading. There is no question. There's a lot of other things also happening. You're trying to figure out, you're trying setting up the PCB, you're setting a page table. There are lots of other things happening anyway. So, and if the process is going to run for a long period, it's well, maybe worth the cost, maybe not.
Would you actually be setting up a page table if you were using...
Not a page table in this case, this is not paging, this is contiguous allocation, but you will set up some other registers as you will see. So this is called using the loader, the other option as was mentioned, and it's also referred to as static relocation, by the way, because you actually statically changed all the address at load time, you stuck that process somewhere, and that's where it is going to stay for its lifetime in the system. It cannot move, because all the addresses are hardwired. They're actually in the instructions themselves. There's nothing you can do. If you change the location, all the addresses are incorrect at that point. So you cannot move it once you do static relocation. Okay? The other option is what was suggested earlier. You do this at runtime. This is basically all the address translation is going to happen at runtime. Okay? So CPU will try to execute an instruction. It will basically, you will have this instruction. It says load 0x10. You try to execute this instruction, you will have to take this operand, will have to send it to the translation logic. This is some hardware that you have in the system. That's that logical address 0x10. You have a relocation or it's called a base register. Okay, this is where you have stored that address 900. So you take 900, you take 10, you do an addition, that gives you a physical address. Okay, you're also going to do safety, you're going to check. Okay? Is that value actually exceeding the limit register? If it exceeds the limit register, you will throw a trap because it says out of bounds memory address. It's an out of bound trap. Okay. Now this, although it is more flexible because you are doing it at runtime, has come with a cost. Every memory instruction that has a memory, not memory, every assembly instruction that has a memory operand involves doing extra arithmetic to actually get the physical address. In particular, you are doing an addition here. Okay. Now, this is not an add assembly instruction. This is actually a piece of hardware. This is called an adder. I don't know if any of you did a 201 and know what adders are. Okay. This is a piece of set of Boolean logic that is just going to do binary addition for you. Okay. Nevertheless, there is a cost involved and there is going to be some efficiency reductions because to actually execute that instruction, first you have to send that address to this translation logic. It's going to give you a new address, which is the actual address, and you will also do some checks there. And only then can you execute that instruction. Okay? So, there will be, now, luckily the adders are not going to impose a huge cost. They can be implemented efficiently in hardware. So, but there is a cost. There's increase in hardware cost and runtime cost. Yes.
But the adder is also required when we are doing
static relocation or something. Like in static relocation, when we hit any user address, we need to change the address to like adding the base address plus offset. So in static relocation, you did it when the process was loaded from disk into RAM. You don't have an adder. You are actually scanning machine code. You are saying, this is load, there's a memory operand that says 10, take that 10, take 900 and rewrite that machine code by saying now that is 910. Okay. So you actually loaded a process which actually addresses physical memory, which no longer addresses, doesn't generate virtual addresses, it's directly addressing physical RAM because you've done the translation once and for all. Okay, this is, so you don't need any hardware to do address translation. You may need hardware to do this safety checks. okay? Because that you can only do at runtime. You can't assume that code is going to do the right thing. Yes, question.
Does the cost of translation matter in comparison to how long it actually takes to get the whatever's at the physical memory address?
Okay, so question is, does the cost of translation matter in relation to the cost of the instruction? Typically, you want the cost of translation to be significantly smaller than the cost or length of the CPU instruction execution cycle. Okay, so otherwise, it's a significant overhead. And luckily, this is not a high cost. Okay, I mean, adders don't take one clock cycle to do it. They can be more efficient than that. Okay, so. Yes, so if it took an entire cycle, then you doubled the time to execute a simple instruction. So you are going to execute half as fast. Right, so all these things do have an impact on efficiency. This one doesn't. Okay, we will see more sophisticated schemes that involve a lot more translation. Okay, they will actually have an impact, as we will see. Okay, but this is very simple technique. Okay, this is just going to do relocation for us. So now we know how you, when you compile, you have no knowledge of where the process is going to be resident in RAM, yet we can load that process wherever we want, okay, and use a small piece of hardware and get that process to run correctly, because all the addressing is going to come out right because the process is contiguous, okay, and we are going to just take a simple register, which is a base register, and generate addresses relative to that base, just by adding that base to all of the addresses. Yes.
So the second point, doesn't the address need to be less than the limit register?
Does the address need to be less than the limit register? If you generated negative offsets, typically, which you don't, then you need to make sure that you do an extra check, which is this less than the limit. Typically, the address has to lie between a base and an offset. Okay? The assumption is that offsets are positive, not negative. Okay, because when you put them into a register, they will be interpreted as a positive integer. The register doesn't understand what a negative integer is. Okay, so negative integers, which are basically just bits, will just become some positive integer in the overall regime, and we will just basically have to do this. Was that your question, or that's not?
No, I mean, just the words. I mean, I understand the graph. It's the words, address must be less than base.
Hardware compare?
Shouldn't the address be less than the
limit? Limit. Well, that's a typo. That should be, address should be less than limit. Yes. Okay. But what I was pointing out was, if you allowed negative offset, you would need an extra check that you are not doing some addressing that's above the base, which you don't make it go above here, neither do you go below your limit. Okay, yes.
This makes total sense to me, but the picture of memory we're drawing doesn't include any sort of cache, L1 or L2 cache or anything. Is that because at this point when we were using these techniques, we weren't using cache, or is that because cache is a separate problem and we're going to worry about that separately?
Okay. So there are two answers. So question is being asked is, there is no cache in the picture. How do caches work? Where did caches not exist when these things were invented, or were caches in the picture? So you will see different kinds of caches. Caches are coming. We'll see them when we do memory management. But there are two or three different kinds of caches. There are simple caches that just store data and or instructions. Okay? And what would happen in that case is, after you have generated this physical address, you will first go and actually look in the cache. Is that physical address, whatever was stored, is it stored in the cache? If so, you fetch it from there. If not, you go to the main memory and fetch it from. I haven't said what happens after this. So you can still put a cache. This is just a physical address. So you are going to go into the cache and say, is offset 910 already cached in my L1 or L2 cache? If so, get it from there. If it's a cache miss, go to RAM.
Okay.
That's one kind of cache. And that can coexist nicely with here. I just talked about memory translation. I didn't say how do you take this physical address and fetch anything yet. And that is where caches will come into the picture. Okay. There are other kinds of caches. I was mentioning of TLB or translation lookaside buffer. Those caches actually stored what is translated here. Those actually store some addresses and so on. And we'll see how to use them in the context of memory management. Okay. So we'll see different kinds of caches in this discussion. Yeah, but more than caches, what should be bothering you is the restriction saying this is all contiguous. Okay? Okay, basically now you can ask that question, how do you decide what a size of a process should be when you are loading it, when it hasn't even begun execution? When you start a random process, are you going to allocate 10 megabytes of RAM? Because you don't know what a stack and heap is going to be. You can, the process may start mallocing like crazy, or it may not use too much heap at all. You meaning the OS, doesn't know that a priori when it loads up. Okay? You can take a guess and say, I'm going to give this process 500 words, or maybe 500 kilobytes, or 500 megabytes, whatever it is. You can do that, but you have no guarantee that it can actually stay within that limit. Okay? So processes over their course of execution may grow or shrink depending on how much memory they allocate, or how large the stack grows, how many threads they have. If there are more threads, each thread has its own stack, and so on and so forth. Okay? So if you cannot predict a priori how large a process is going to be, then how do you do contiguous allocation? Because if I stuck C next to A is sandboxed between A and B and C. Okay, if it grows, it cannot. Then it will basically say there is no memory to grow, even though there is a piece of memory region here that's free. Yes, question.
So, like, if we're talking about process C, and we want to, like, expand it, like, you had a couple of slides back where you generate processes of, run at runtime. Could you actually just change the limit register to go down?
So here, in this case, C is the only process that can actually grow without any problem because it's unallocated free memory here. So you can just grow it and increase its limit register, has been pointed out. Okay? But A and B cannot grow because there is no free memory sitting next to them in physical RAM. The only way to grow A potentially is to take it here and stick it somewhere here and leave some extra space. Okay? So what I'm saying is typically contiguous allocation is not a good idea if you have dynamic processes that grow and shrink. Okay? So the first assumption we want to relax next time is we don't want to do contiguous allocation. We want something that's more flexible. Okay? We want to be able to split processes and put them in different regions. Why store A contiguously? Why not store part of A here and part of A here? Okay, what's wrong with that? But if you do that and the process is split, how is address translation going to work? Right? Because you can no longer use a single base register. That base register is meaningless if there is something else sitting between the process. It's split across five different regions of memory. Would you do a base register for each of those chunks? Right? So you have something to say.
You would split it up into pages, right? And then you keep track of the start and end of each page.
Right. So we'll look at several schemes. One is paging. There's another one called segmentation. There's yet another one called segmented paging that will have different properties based on what we are trying to achieve, and they'll each have different address translation logic. We'll see that these become complicated, so you throw in caches to improve efficiency. Okay? So that's how real systems will work. This is just a simplified picture of what you could have done, but typically you don't want to do this, okay, unless you want your processes not to grow at all. So let's stop here for today. Next time we'll talk about other memory systems.
Yes.